Thank you very much, Dr. Dirks, for that very kind introduction. It is a great honor for me to address this esteemed group this evening, and I wish to express my gratitude to Dr. Dirks and to the Vancouver Institute for this invitation. Mrs. Martin and I have enjoyed our first visit to Vancouver this week. Despite the fact that I grew up, as you heard, across the mountains, this is the first time I've actually visited this wonderful city. We are appreciative of the very fine weather that you've provided for us, and I can say that it's been a special holiday coming from Boston, where January is usually marked by unpleasantly cold weather. Since Dr. Dirks has alluded to my ethnic background, I think I must tell you my favorite Mennonite ethnic joke. Story goes that a Jew, a Hindu, and a Mennonite were traveling through the valley of the Okanagan when their automobile broke down. And they sought somewhere to spend the night. It was late in the afternoon. They approached a local farmer and rapped on the door, and with the usual hospitable characteristics of the farmers of that area, they were invited in and invited to stay the night. However, said the farmer, I'm afraid that I only have two beds in the house, and it'll be necessary for one of you to sleep in the barn. And the Hindu was delighted to assume that responsibility and said, I'll gladly sleep in the barn, and found his way there, and everyone settled down for the evening, for the night. A few minutes later, there was a rap on the door, and the Hindu appeared and said, there's a cow in the barn. He said, you know, Hindus and cows are not supposed to sleep in the same building. I'm afraid that I can't sleep in the barn. So the Jew said, that's fine. He said, I'd be pleased to do it. So he went to the barn and everyone settled down again. And shortly thereafter, there was another knock at the door and there was the Jew. And he said, there are pigs in the barn. He said, you know, Jews and pigs can't sleep in the same building. I'm sorry, I can't do that. Well, the Mennonite said, fine, glad to sleep in the barn. So everyone settled down, hopefully for the last time, when there was a knock on the door and the farmer in exasperation got up, went to the door, and there were the pig and the cow. The other comment I have is that I only missed the conservative election by 1 year. Joe Clark was a year behind me at the University of Alberta. I'm glad he's in Winnipeg tonight and I'm here. I think we are accustomed to thinking of the brain in certain ways. And I'm sure many of you wondered as you read about the title of this talk this evening, what in the world is Dr. Martin going to talk about, hormones and the brain? We tend to think of the brain as the structure that allows us to move our arms and legs, as the part of our organism which allows us to appreciate the world around us, the five senses that bring to us the appreciations of the things that we can see, hear, feel, touch, and smell. We also think of the brain in terms of intellectual functions, of memory, of reasoning, of language, and when we wax philosophical, we inquire whether the brain is the same as the mind, whether the human mind or spirit somehow is more than the brain itself, or whether it's the same. It's in this direction that I want to take the discussion tonight. All of you are aware, I think, that the brain is important for certain functions that we refer to as automatic, that occur without our voluntary control. But are you aware that the brain, in fact, regulates how tall you grow, how much you eat, how much you sleep, and how you feel? Have you ever wondered why there are good days and then there are bad days? Why do you feel so lousy after you arrive in Europe until your rhythms get back into shape? Why do joggers insist that they feel high when they run? How do lie detectors work? Why do athletes not feel pain when they get hurt? Those are some of the questions that come to mind, and in which I hope as we go through the discussion this evening, I may be able to provide some insight into them. I've got a double set of slides, which we've been practicing on for the last half an hour. I hope they work all right. We'll give it a try, and let's go. The first two slides, I'm going to sit here so that I can actually look at them with you, tell us two of the principal issues that I want to discuss with you tonight. How does the brain talk to the hormone-producing glands? And secondly, how does the brain use all of the hormones that it seems to also contain to talk to itself? I want to start with the slide shown on your left, and there's more information on some of these slides than you need to worry about. Please just worry about the things I say. Don't try to read everything you see on each of these slides. I'm going to briefly this evening cover four general areas shown on the diagram at your left. It's conventional often to think of the brain as a black box, as shown at the top here, and to have it connected subsequently to other black boxes which it regulates or which in turn regulate it. And I'll begin the lecture this evening by talking about the relationship between the brain and the pituitary gland. I'll then make some comments about the relationship between the brain and the autonomic nervous system, that part of us that regulates itself without conscious drives affecting it very much. I'll briefly talk about aspects of sensation as an introduction to the problem of pain, and then conclude with what is perhaps the hottest topic in neuroscience or neurology and in psychiatry these days. That is the fact that the brain seems to make virtually every hormone that any of the glands in the body makes, and that these hormones in the brain are used for a multitude of functions, which will have great importance for neurologic disease, for psychiatric disease, and so on. Now let's begin with the pituitary gland, shown on the right slide, right part of this slide here. The pituitary gland is a very small nubbin of tissue which sits right square in the middle of your skull. This x-ray at the bottom shows you a bony cavity, which is called the sella turcica, where the pituitary gland sits. It's attached to the base of the brain, as you can see at the top here, by a stalk. And the portion of the brain just above the pituitary we call the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus, which is the center of much of the information that I will discuss tonight, is itself even smaller than the pituitary. It's about as big as your thumbnail in size, and it contains within it a host of substances which tell the pituitary gland what it ought to do. So for the first few minutes, I'd like to discuss with you the concept of how the hypothalamus serves, in a sense, as the conductor of the endocrine orchestra. The pituitary gland produces a large number of hormones, and the way it regulates the secretion of those hormones, I'll show you, is dependent minute to minute by what the brain tells it to do. Now, shown on the left side here is an enlargement of that pituitary gland. And the blue portion here of that pituitary gland is the part that makes all the hormones that we associate with normal reproductive function, the ability to have children, normal growth, normal regulation of the thyroid gland, regulation of the adrenal gland, and so on. You'll notice that it's attached to the hypothalamus by a stalk, but the way in which the brain talks to the pituitary is through a blood vessel system shown here in red. And there are nerve cells in the hypothalamus, actual brain cells, that make the chemical factors which tell each of the pituitary hormones what they should do, whether they should be secreted in bigger amounts or smaller amounts. And those brain hormones, brain substances, are secreted into this vascular tree, which carries them then to the anterior pituitary to regulate secretion. Now, shown on your right is a very dramatic picture of how remarkably vascular, how many blood vessels there are in this region. The blood supply to this part of the brain and the pituitary gland is the richest and the greatest of any region of the body. Tremendous amounts of blood are passed through here. And you can see on the right side that here are the large arteries going to the brain, and coming off at this point is an artery at right angles to the large carotid artery, which travels into the base of the hypothalamus, and blood is there distributed in this region, as shown on the right side, on the left slide. It's then collected into veins, which carries it down to the pituitary. Now, the way this particular picture was taken was a plastic dye was injected into the blood vessels of a monkey. And then the pituitary gland was taken out, and all of the tissue was digested away, and one's just left with the cast, the plastic cast, which shows the blood vessels and nothing else. So you can see that the entire pituitary is really just a big blood vessel. Now, the brain tells the pituitary what to do by secreting hormones from the hypothalamus, which then reach the pituitary. Now, if you go to medical school these days, you now turn off your, if you're in a lecture like this, you turn your eyes away and go to sleep, because the amount of information that's accumulated in this area just in the past few years is really enormous. So I don't want you to worry about all the details in this slide. But look here at the pituitary hormones, and look at the top at the numbers of factors which have now been identified in the hypothalamus which regulate each of the hormones in the pituitary. So here we have the pituitary gland, here we have the hypothalamus. Let's just quickly glance at some of the important hormones. I'm going to talk a lot about growth hormone tonight. That's the hormone that makes us grow, and I'll show how that hormone is regulated in some detail. I'll also talk about ACTH, which is the hormone that stimulates the adrenal gland to make cortisone. And that's probably the most important of all hormones. If you don't have that hormone, you won't live for more than 24 or 48 hours. Shown on this side then, if we start with growth hormone, is a diagram that shows the hypothalamus with some of the nerve cells that make the regulatory hormones that control it. You can see that those nerve cells secrete their stimulatory factors into the base of the hypothalamus to reach the anterior pituitary, where stimulation of growth hormone secretion occurs. Growth hormone is shown on the left in a diagram form. It's a hormone because it's made up of a series of amino acids. All the proteins in the body are regulated by genetic mechanisms, and growth hormone is an example of a hormone made up of 191 amino acids. And very often hormones of this size have bridges between them here, which we call disulfide bonds. Now, this hormone is absolutely crucial for normal achievement of body height. If you don't have enough of it, or if you have none of it, you only grow to about 2 feet and a few inches, and you're a midget. If you have too much of it, and you have too much of it while you're growing, you become a giant, a pituitary giant. And in Boston, where the Celtics play well, I wonder how many of them have too much growth hormone. But for them, it's worked out fine. The interesting thing is that growth hormone, which we know we need for probably about 16 to 18 years of our life, from the time we start to grow until we cease growing, growth hormone has a very long action during our lives. And yet, if you look at how it's secreted, as shown on the right, its secretion is an intermittent, irregular, episodic pattern. And what this shows is one 16-year-old boy who has a catheter placed in a vein so that blood samples can be taken every 15 minutes, and growth hormone is measured every 15 minutes for 24 hours. This is the day period, and this is the night period. During much of that time, growth hormone isn't detectable in the blood. But every once in a while, you'll see these prominent bursts of secretion, and this represents the sleep period. And early in sleep, there's a very prominent sleep-associated surge of growth hormone secretion. And those of you who are grandmothers in the audience probably still tell your grandchildren that an hour of sleep before midnight is worth 2 hours of sleep after midnight. Well, maybe it's good to get all the sleep you can. See that big surge of growth hormone secretion. Now, this is entirely dependent upon the brain. And if you have a disorder that injures the hypothalamus, like a tumor or a head injury, then growth failure occurs because the hypothalamus can no longer tell the pituitary to secrete its growth hormone in this fashion. Too much growth hormone can cause several problems, which I want to review in just a moment. But before doing that, let me just quickly show you the kind of complicated regulation system that an endocrinologist needs to think about in terms of how the final output from the pituitary of one hormone occurs. Here one has the entire brain represented by a number of squiggles here and there. If you exercise, growth hormone is secreted. When you're stressed, whether psychologically or physically, growth hormone is secreted. And when one goes to sleep, if you fall into a deep sleep, growth hormone is secreted. That indicates that a number of higher functions can affect the hormonal balance of your body. And one can say the same thing for any one of the hormones that you want to consider, that a variety of different factors will tell the pituitary to increase or decrease its hormone secretion, and you can already begin to imagine all of the kinds of perturbations that might occur from various dysfunctions of the psyche in terms of what the hormones do. Now let me show you an example here of a case of too much growth hormone secretion. And I think our one slide projector has quit, but let me show you while our projectionist tries to fix it. This is an example of too much growth hormone. It's a father and a son. This gentleman developed a tumor on the pituitary, which produced too much growth hormone. And you can notice the striking changes in his physical appearance. Large nose, prominent ridges over the eyes, a very prominent jaw, large ears. This we call acromegaly. And if one looks a little closer, you can see again the features of this very disabling disorder. And I've got to have the other slide there. This particular gentleman had a pituitary tumor. And if I can show you the CAT scan, which the projectionist, I hope, is bringing along for me in a moment, I'll show you how the ability to do an X-ray through the skull using the sophisticated equipment of computer axial tomography permits us to make a very clear diagnosis of an excessive amount of growth hormone secretion in a patient like this due to a pituitary tumor. I can hear things happening. Yeah. Now, it turns out that, in fact, one can operate on such pituitary tumors with very little risk to the patient. I need that backed up just a few. Can you reverse that about three slides, please? Okay, let's move ahead. Hope it'll go. Don't worry. Let's go on to the next concept. Ignore the one on the right for the moment. The next hormone that I want to talk about is the hormone that regulates the secretion of cortisol from the adrenal glands. And you see here another diagram of how the brain, represented by the squiggly line at the top, regulates the hypothalamus, which in turn secretes its own factor to regulate the pituitary, which then releases the hormone that stimulates the adrenal gland, and cortisol, the life-giving hormone, is secreted by the adrenal gland. This particular system is of great interest recently because it's clear that when various functions of this particular system are put into play, let me see if I can get this one back now. This was the pituitary tumor that I wanted to show you. These are CAT scans of the skull showing the patient who had the pituitary tumor on the right side. And if you look in the center of the skull where the pituitary gland sits, you can see this white golf ball size tumor, which was the cause of that excess amount of growth hormone production. The patient was operated on, and on this side, the tumor is now gone. Now, the interesting thing about the system that I just mentioned is that when the pituitary cell secretes the hormone that stimulates the adrenal gland, which we call ACTH, it also secretes a large family of other hormones. And particularly important in that regard is the fact that part of this family includes a hormone called beta endorphin. Now, beta endorphin is one of the hormones referred to as an opioid hormone or an endorphin. And these are hormones that are made in the body which have effects very similar to the effects of narcotics. So that, as you'll see, the pituitary, and later on I'll show you the brain as well, secretes hormones, peptide substances, which have the same effect naturally, they're present normally, as the narcotics that we obtain from plants. The other point about this system, which is shown on the right-hand side, is that just as I showed you for growth hormone, the secretion of the adrenal hormones stimulated by ACTH are also not a steady state output system, but an intermittent episodic pulsatile pattern of secretion. And if you notice in this individual sampled over a 24-hour period, sleep is shown at the top. The catheter was placed at 2200 hours, that's 10 o'clock in the evening, and blood samples taken every 15 minutes throughout the night, the levels of cortisol show a very striking change throughout the day and night. While you're sleeping, they tend to show these sudden surges of activity, and by the time you wake up in the morning, your circulating levels of cortisol are the highest in the 24-hour period. And then as you go about your work during the day, there tends to be less secretion, and by the time you come home for dinner and start watching TV in the evening, cortisol levels are very low. Now that we call a circadian or a diurnal rhythm. And it means that the brain has told the hormone-producing glands to produce more cortisol for the morning period and less for the evening period. And this rhythm, if everything's working right, is a very important determinant of a lot of the activities that you engage in throughout the day. The majority of people find that their best time of the day is in the morning, and that their worst time of the day is in the afternoon, 4 o'clock to 6 o'clock. And this rhythm probably is very important in determining of that kind of feeling. Now the interesting thing is that jogging, at least in Boston, has become a major event. This is a picture of the Boston Marathon, which we celebrate every April. But it's interesting how many ordinary people, many of my friends I find, have taken up jogging. And it's also interesting how many of those people say that jogging makes them feel high or very good. Well, there's some physiologic basis for believing that hormones may have something to do with that. Because, in fact, we have shown in a paper that we published a year and a half ago in the New England Journal of Medicine that if you take young women and have them get conditioned, start off with women who are not acclimated or accustomed to heavy running, look at the hormone secretions that occur during exercise, and particularly measure the endorphins, which are part of the molecule that I showed you on the last slide. And then you condition the woman for a month, and then retest, and then condition even more for another month, and then retest, one finds that the amount of endorphins secreted actually increase. So that the blood levels of the material naturally made in the body can be shown to increase. Now what that means physiologically, and whether that's an important aspect of why runners feel good, is still a mystery. But there is at least a hormonal basis for suspecting that running does have changes in metabolism which may affect mood, may affect one's general sense of well-being. Of interest in the case of the woman runner is another finding, and that is that if a woman increases the amount of exercise that she undertakes to the point where she runs 100 to 120 miles a week, that's a lot of running, and there aren't many women runners who run that far. But in fact, that amount of exercise leads to changes in reproductive functions, so that a substantial number of women who run that much actually stop being able to have children, and some of them stop having menstrual periods. This was first recognized with ballet dancers, who exercise a great deal. And if, in fact, you go to a ballet school, as was shown at one of the schools in New York, a large percentage of the ballet dancers who work out vigorously, in fact, have no menstrual periods at all. So exercise can influence a number of hormones, some in a beneficial way, others in a way that one might think was not beneficial. And yet, from the adaptive standpoint, one could understand that for a woman who was busy trying to survive, let's say, in a primitive society where she had to work very hard and perhaps had to take her children over hundreds of miles to survive, that it would be inappropriate for her to be capable of having other children during that period of time. So there's probably an adaptive function to the cessation of reproductive capacity in the face of heavy exercise. This was in the New Yorker some months ago. This poor couple, let me read the caption. "You should try race walking," the man says to the lady. "It's better for you than running. It's good for your cardiovascular system, and at the end of 15 minutes, your glands excrete a juice that will make you happy." Now, you should appreciate that if you go back to the pituitary gland, which makes 7 or 8 different hormones, that the hypothalamus is telling the pituitary to do its thing throughout an entire period of time, like a 24-hour period. Each hormone is under separate control, and each hormone is doing its own thing in a apparently separate way. And yet, in actual fact, there's a major coordinator. There's a big clock. It's actually very tiny, but it's a grandfather clock that sits in the hypothalamus and puts all of these rhythms together so that all of the things that happen on a day-by-day basis can be coordinated and integrated to make us work the best. Now let's look at some of the things that happen together. On the left-hand side, you see 2 days. This is one 24-hour period, and this is the second 24-hour period. And this top part shows you the sleep-wake cycle. This particular individual sleeps here during this period of time. It's awake during this period of time, and then sleeps again, as shown by the black bars. Body temperature shown in the second slide. I don't know if those of you at the back of the room can see this, but body temperature has a remarkable fluctuation throughout the 24-hour period. You can see the changes here. Tends to fall during sleep, to rise in the morning, rise during the day, fall during sleep. Here's the growth hormone secretion that I've already talked about. Dramatic surge of secretion during sleep, even in adults, not just in growing children. And here's the cortisol rhythm that I've already referred to, falling off during the day, peaking during the night to the early morning, falling off. And here is secretion of potassium, which is just a mineral that's found in the blood and secreted in the urine. Now, all of this rhythmic activity is in fact coordinated so that the body doesn't get all confused about what hormone should be doing what. And what you see on the right-hand side is the normal circumstance where the cue of light and dark, or of sleep and wake, is shown. And so all of these rhythms peak at the same time or have the same cycle. The interesting thing is that the clock that I'm going to tell you about in a moment not only works to make all of these things line up when you have a cue like light and dark, but if you put us in a cave, as has been done with researchers in France, or if you do an experiment where you lock somebody in a room, let them choose when they want to sleep, you don't let them have a radio or a television or give them the newspaper so they don't know what time of the day it is, But you let them do their own requesting for food, their own, make their own decision about when they sleep, and so on. Even in the absence of any cue from the external environment, you will establish a rhythm, which interestingly has a greater than a 24-hour period for almost everybody. So that if you go down in a cave, you have no cues about what time it is, day or night, you will probably establish a rhythm, but it will continue to be a regular rhythm of about 26 hours. And this is shown here. By each day, things would happen just a bit later. Virtually no one does this, so that for some reason, the clock, which ticks whether or not it gets a cue from outside, tends to tick somewhat slower than the rotation of the Earth. This is shown here in an actual experiment where an individual was followed over several months, and each of these represent a day period, so that you see the sleep period is the black bar. And then at this point, the individual was taken away from the usual cues of light and darkness and was allowed to free run. And you can see that the sleep period gradually drifted toward the right side. Then he was scheduled again with the light-dark cycle and came back into alignment. Well, it turns out that the little clock that regulates all of these rhythms together and which stimulates a normal cycle is found in the hypothalamus, and it's as big as this little white dot here, shown just on top of the optic chiasm. As the nerves come in from the eyes, they cross in the front of the brain in the optic chiasm. And sitting just above them is the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And these tiny nuclei, which were found in rats about 10 years ago, have direct connections from the eyes. And in fact, this experiment is done by placing radioactive amino acids into the back of the eye in an animal, and then those are transported from the eye into the hypothalamus, and they show direct connections with this clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus. Here you can see it in larger projection. This white spot is the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And this nucleus, shown here as the SCN, has direct connections from the outside, so that light waves coming to the eye goes to the suprachiasmatic nucleus, it connects to other regions of the brain, and then produces circadian rhythms, so that everything is tuned into the same time. Here you can see that you can build hierarchical models of the suprachiasmatic nucleus influencing all kinds of other sub-clocks. But there's one big clock, the grandfather clock, a very tiny nucleus, which interestingly begins to be rhythmic in the developing brain even before it has any connections from the eyes. So there's a little cluster of nerve cells which has its own rhythmicity. One of the great mysteries in neurobiology is how a group of cells, nerve cells like that, can function as a unit when they don't have any connections from outside to tell them how to function together. Well, this should be Air Canada, but it's Delta. And it illustrates one of the common problems we all face when we travel, and that's jet lag. And shown in this slide, one has to, when you fly from east to west or west to east, readjust all of these rhythms to bring them back into synchronization. And you should be able to tell me now, on the basis of what I've told you about the spontaneous rhythm, you ought to be able to predict which way is easiest to fly.
West.
West, right. Because it's easy for us to lengthen our day, but it's very difficult for us to shorten our days. And so in general, people find, and jet lag gets worse as you grow older, I can attest to that, that it's easier to fly west because you can lengthen your day and fall back into sync much easier than when you fly to Europe and you need to advance your clock. It's very hard to do that, and it usually takes a week to advance that. The cortisol rhythm, that diurnal rhythm, takes 7 to 10 days to come back into a sleep-wake cycle, particularly when you fly east. Now, this is a complicated slide, but I just want to try to get across a very interesting recent observation made by the group at Montefiore Hospital in New York about how one can actually treat some patients with psychiatric difficulties or insomnia with depression by playing with the clock that regulates sleep. Now, if you'll bear with me through this slide, I'll point out the factors. And I'll, for those of you who can't see at the back of the room, I'll try to tell you what it shows. This poor chap, who actually was a medical student, was having difficulty sleeping through the night because he'd go to bed at the time he was supposed to, which is around midnight, but he could never fall asleep until 2-3 in the morning. And then he'd have to get up in the morning and go to class, and every night he simply didn't get enough sleep. He felt rotten until the weekend, when he went to sleep at 3 or 4, slept until noon, felt fine. Then he'd go back to school on Monday. When he had to get to bed on time, he couldn't go to sleep, but he had to get up. And this cycle kept on continuing until he went on vacation. When he went on vacation, everything was fine. He went to bed at 3 in the morning, got up at 11, felt fine. Well, he was brought into the sleep laboratory for evaluation, and it was very clear that if you tried to make him go to sleep early, he didn't sleep at all. But if you let him sleep during the time that he was supposed to sleep, according to his clock, everything went fine. So he was actually treated by allowing his clock to advance. And you can see that during this period of time, he was slowly advanced night by night until he got into the right timing for an appropriate sleep. This individual could not back his clock up. And each time he had a weekend off to ruin his clock, he then had 5 days of inability to sleep. When his clock was finally advanced and put into the right sync, he was fine. He went off as an intern, and nobody's heard from him since. What I show you now is sleep itself, the patterns of normal sleep, which are also synchronized by clocks in the brain. And this slide illustrates on the left-hand side the pattern of sleep that's characteristic in a young adult, where sleep occurs quickly when going to bed, descends into the deepest stage and is prolonged there for an hour or so, and then is interrupted usually 4 or maybe 5 times by periods of what's called rapid eye movement or dream sleep. So that normal sleep consists of cycles of slow wave, rapid eye movement, slow wave, rapid eye movement, slow wave, rapid eye movement. As you can see that as the night progresses, one tends to spend more time in rapid eye movement sleep, and it's called that because the eyes actually do jump. And about 80% of the time, if you wake an individual during that period of time, they will be dreaming. So it's the period of sleep when we dream. You don't remember a dream very long because if the dream has occurred more than 10 minutes before you're awakened, you forget it. So when you remember a dream, it's happened within 10 or 15 minutes before you are actually awakened. Now this sleep pattern, which is very healthy and most individuals between 10 and 20 feel rested and have no troubles, changes in virtually everyone as we grow older. And you can see in the elderly that it's very rare to get into deep sleep. That even, first of all, when you go to sleep, it takes longer to get to sleep. Deep sleep occurs less often. There are more frequent awakenings when you actually feel that you are awake. And there's much less dream sleep and rapid eye movement sleep. So that as we grow older, the brain itself changes its cyclicity. and sleeping is less satisfactory for most of us. Now, it's interesting if you look at the effects, let's ignore the one on the left and look at the right, of aging on one hormone rhythm, namely growth hormone secretion. And these three panels show the differences in growth hormone secretion between an early child who's not growing. The middle panel is the bursts of secretion that occur during normal growth. And the bottom panel is someone who's reached about 40 or 50 years of age. Growth hormone secretion still occurs even though growth is stopped, but it ceases completely by about age 55 or 60. Now, growth hormone is very important for growth. We're not too sure what else it does. Whether that fall off in growth hormone secretion may be important, in other words, might contribute in some way to the aging process, is something that is currently under investigation. It's conceivable that when bacteria make enough growth hormone, which is now being done, so that molecular biology has found a way to produce growth hormone that's going to be useful for treatment of those children who fail to grow, it's conceivable that in the next decade or so, growth hormone treatment as a form of hormone replacement in the elderly will become a reality. That's controversial, but it's something that will certainly be looked at. Now let's talk just for a minute, a very short time, because I know time is moving more quickly than I thought, about the autonomic nervous system. That's section two of this slide. When I was being introduced here tonight, my pulse rate was about 135. And I was feeling tense and sweaty, and despite the fact that I've talked many times before, every time I talk, I have that response. And that's my brain acting through the autonomic nervous system, speeding up my heart to get me ready to either fight or flee. And it's a common experience for a speaker to have that moment of panic just before you get up to wonder why you got yourself into this. And that is the brain working through a part of the nervous system that we really have very little control over. And it's that kind of thing that is used by the law enforcement authorities to produce the lie detector test. If one has an emotional response, which presumably for normal people occurs when a lie is told, then one can measure by taking the pulse rate, the blood pressure, and the sweating that occurs in the palms of the hand. One can detect changes electrically that the patient or the subject would never be aware of, which is a signal to the person who's taking the detector test, who's running it, that that individual has shown a sign of stress or of an emotional response. And that's all a lie detector is. But it can be surprisingly reliable because our bodies respond to the brain signals in a way that we can never entirely get rid of. I don't know if you can see this at the back of the room, but this is the way I feel sometimes. Here's this guy sitting at his desk, running his department, and people come in and stand quietly and wait for you to tell them what to do, when inside you feel like a little kid, crying, screaming, wishing you could go do what you'd really like to do. Those of you who can't see it at the back, it says, they're reading the bulletin board, and it says, "Too bad about old Ainsworth, published and published, but perished all the same." Well, I'd like to finish my talk this evening by getting to what is perhaps the most exciting recent area of this whole field. And that is, how does the brain use all the hormones to talk to itself? The brain is composed of more than 10 billion individual nerve cells. That's probably a very small estimate of the actual number. An individual nerve cell is an electrical structure which has a variety of different shapes. Here's one on the left-hand side. The neurologists in the crowd will recognize a Purkinje cell in the cerebellum, which has a cell body. It has a very diffuse dendritic tree. And the dendrites are all of the processes that go out from the cell body to feel the environment on which contacts are made by other nerve cells to form the entire network that we think of as the mature brain. Here's another cell that's in the caudate nucleus. This particular cell, stained with Golgi, has a central nucleus. The dendrites go out in a number of directions, and here, if you look closely, you'll see a fine process that's going off, which is called the axon, and that's the part of the nerve cell that is carrying the message on to the next nerve cell. Now, nerve cells come in many different shapes and many different sizes, and one can stain them with a variety of different techniques. One of the major advances in the past few years in neuroanatomy has been to develop a variety of new techniques to label these cells and to try to learn something about what each one of them contains. The typical structure of a nerve cell is shown on the left-hand side here, with the cell body, the dendrites here that receive the incoming communication, and the axon which leaves the cell, which sometimes is coated with myelin. That's the problem that arises in multiple sclerosis, where damage occurs to the myelin sheath, which forms an insulator for the nerve fiber. And the damage tends to occur to the insulation, but the axon itself is spared. So that conduction is slowed and is abnormal, and the symptoms of multiple sclerosis emerge. Now, this nerve cell, which may receive 10,000 inputs to one cell from other parts of the brain, then sends out its output through the axons. And shown on the right-hand side is the working point where one of those nerve cells communicates with the next. And you can imagine that this is the axon coming here, and that it's communicating at what we call a synapse, which is a very thin connection between two cells. And the message from one cell to the other is carried by a chemical substance, by a messenger, which gives information from one cell to the next, either to stimulate it or to inhibit it. And that's the way the whole brain works. Those 10 billion neurons all working together to turn each other on or to turn each other off. Now, the major discovery of the past decade is that all of the hormones in your body are also found in the brain. So that the hormones of the pituitary are also found in the brain. The hormones in the gut, like insulin and glucagon, are also found in the brain. These are generally referred to as neuroactive peptides. A peptide is simply a word for a chain of amino acids, and it tends to be called a peptide when it's when it's short, and when it gets longer, like growth hormone was, it's sometimes called a hormone or a protein. So peptides tend to be very small, anywhere from 3 to 30 amino acids in length. Now, it turns out that these areas that connect one nerve cell to the other, the synapse shown on the left-hand side, are full of these neuropeptides. They are found in virtually all regions of the nervous system, and it's conceivable that some of these substances are found in virtually every nerve cell, although that's not known for sure. And there are many different kinds of them. This is a joke slide, which suggests that each of the hormones is just part of another hormone. In fact, they're made by different mechanisms. Each one of them comes from a different precursor, different pro-hormone. But the synaptic regions of the nerve cells contain these substances. This is a list of some of the other hormones, just to show you some of their structures. And the most interesting aspect to date of this whole business has been the discovery that I've already alluded to, that the brain makes its own morphine. Now, morphine was discovered centuries, in fact millennia ago, as a potent material, heroin, narcotic substances were found originally from the poppy. The poppy, which still supports a very large and illegal trade throughout the world, contains a capsule in the center, which when opened with a fine knife will yield a juice. And that juice, when purified, contains the most potent agents for the relief of pain that doctors have ever found. And this material still is the principal way by which we administer assistance and help to individuals who have severe pain. The remarkable thing is that the brain contains receptors or targets upon which the products of the poppy can act. So that in fact, if you take the juice from the capsule of the poppy, that juice, when purified to yield the narcotic substance, can be shown that that narcotic substance actually attaches to receptors in the brain. These are points in the brain upon which those narcotics will act to cause the various effects that we associate with them. In 1975, Hughes and Kosterlitz in Scotland and England discovered that the brain makes its own narcotic. And that was found to be a metenkephalin shown at the top in combination with a second molecule of the same size called leuenkephalin. And that small 5-amino acid structure was the material shown to be present in the nervous system. The endorphins, as shown here, are also found in the brain. They tend to be larger in size and tend to be more potent. Now, there's very good evidence to believe that pain perception itself is dependent also upon neuroactive peptides. And shown on the left-hand part of this slide is a drawing of the nervous system with a cross-section here of the spinal cord, which you find in the spine. And you can imagine that these cells shown here reach out to the skin or to other parts of the body. And when a painful stimulus is perceived, it's carried into the nervous system and then up the spinal cord, where it finally reaches consciousness and is felt as a painful sensation. The material that seems to transmit the pain is a peptide called substance P. And enkephalins are found in abundant quantities in the dorsal part of the spinal cord, where this first pain fiber makes communication with the second fiber, which then carries the message to consciousness. And as shown on the right-hand slide, there's good evidence to believe that enkephalins act, at least one of the places they act, is actually at the level of the spinal cord to prevent this transmission of the painful stimulus coming from the periphery into the spinal cord and then going to the brain. So that enkephalin seemed to be capable of blocking the normal transmission of pain. Now that certainly occurs in the case of the athlete who breaks his ankle but continues to play till the end of the football game. Something happens to prevent him from perceiving the fact that that hurt. When the game's over, then he realizes that in fact he's had an injury. These two slides show you that these pathways, which contain the naturally occurring opioid substances, are very widespread in the nervous system. And on the left-hand side is the distribution of the enkephalins. And one can find cells throughout the nervous system which correspond closely in location to those parts of the brain that we associate with pain transmission, with mood, with changes in feeling, and in fact we're familiar that all of those things are affected when narcotics are given. One gets exactly the same response by giving enkephalins. The endorphins are also found in the nervous system in different nerve cells, but also in a similar distribution. Acupuncture is an interesting topic, and I'm not going to talk about it anymore. But there is some reason to think that certain kinds of acupuncture actually work through the enkephalin or endorphin system. And there is reasonable evidence that acupuncture, which certainly is an effective pain reliever, has its effects through the triggering of the release of the endogenous opioid hormones, triggered perhaps by the stimulation of a peripheral nerve that sets into motion the system that I've described. Acupuncture certainly works in animals. It's been used in racehorses to do surgery. There's reason to believe that, at least for the management of pain in some circumstances, that acupuncture can have a beneficial effect. Well, what for the future? What does the brain do with all the hormones it makes? At this point in time, we're on the frontier of a very exciting new march of science. We have more information than we know what to do with. We have more hormones and more substances that are active in the brain than we know what to do about. We're sort of in the bottleneck here between the discovery and the development. What does this mean for medicine? Well, the answer to that question is very much a matter of speculation. There are a variety of effects of these substances that are quite different from the old chemical messengers that we knew the brain used. For example, there is no question that peptides can affect memory, that they can affect learning, that they can change the state of alertness. And in fact, there's evidence now that those substances that are prescribed so frequently by doctors, Valium, Librium, those agents given for anxiety also have effects on receptors that are present in the brain upon which they attach and somehow produce an alleviation in what we perceive within our minds as anxiousness or anxiety. There's a search on at the moment to try to find the substance that the brain makes naturally that might act like those substances. It's not been found, but if there are receptors present for it, many scientists would say that that means that one day we will find that substance too. There is good evidence that peptides stimulate a number of other functions that we tend to think of as basic functions. The amount we eat, the amount we drink, regulate sleep. Very recently, a group at Harvard have isolated a peptide that they find causes deep sleep. It's been isolated from the spinal fluid and from other secretions of animals, but it appears to have effects to cause sleep. And certainly, a number of peptides are important for modulating pain perception. It would be wonderful if one could find a peptide that would prevent pain but not cause addiction. So far, that has not happened. And the peptides that have been that I've described to you not only can relieve pain, but each of them so far still has the undesirable side effects that we associate with narcotic addiction. I know that people in this city are very excited about the new projects underway, and I, having seen them this week, am excited for you. The techniques of NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, and of positron emission tomography, which this university is making a major effort toward, and I noticed that Her Royal Highness Queen Elizabeth will be visiting the project on her visit here in March. These are remarkable new tools which allow one to do what so far is not possible to do, which is to make some actual determinations of what is going on in the tissues of the human brain without causing any harm or damage in the process. Now, clearly, when someone has difficulty with their liver or difficulty with their lung, the doctor very quickly does a biopsy, takes a piece of tissue, does something in the test tube, and comes up with a diagnosis. You can't do that with the brain. But these new equipment, these new techniques, will permit one to make analyses of how the brain functions in the next decade that will very likely be revolutionary. Here you can see in the NMR scan, which is one of the pictures taken from the Mass General Hospital. We've used this technique there for the past 2.5 years. In one single sitting with the patient inside here so that the technique can be used to scan the brain, a 40-minute period of scanning allows one to take pictures in virtually any plane of the brain. Now, so far we can only use that to see the brain as an image, but we all believe that in a few years we'll be able to make chemical measurements in the brain with this technique. And the same can be said for positron emission tomography, which allows one to actually at this point make metabolic measurements of oxygen uptake, of glucose metabolism, cerebral blood flow, and we believe that within a few years it'll be possible perhaps to look at receptors in the brain, to actually find those points in the nervous system where peptides attach and act. And it'll be possible to make measurements of the functions of the brain using these techniques. And I congratulate your university for taking a major leadership role in this direction. Well, I've run longer than I should have, and I won't summarize. I think you will sense with me some of the excitement that I feel about these various aspects of brain function, and I think I can say that the most important thing for all of us is that science of this sort advance us in the years ahead so that benefits will be felt by the patients who have disorders of the nervous system. Thank you.
for a few questions, and I wanted you to repeat the question.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Martin has consented to answer questions. If you have any questions, would you direct them to him? I should tell you at this stage that as well, he will be going into lecture hall number 6 shortly. So perhaps we could have a few questions here, and then he will go into lecture hall number 6. The question is, have there been any further advances in migraine? And I can say that it's very likely that some of these active substances are involved in both the changes in blood flow that occur with migraine and in the pain that is associated with it. But having said that, we don't know any more about migraine than we did 20 years ago. But I think there's a good chance we will learn something. Yes. Hypnosis certainly can alter the mental state. Hypnosis does not act through the substances that I've talked about. It appears to be a separate, at least does not work through the relief of pain where it has been beneficial, does not work through the endorphin and enkephalin system. So hypnosis is a reality but remains a mystery in terms of exactly what happens to the mental state when it occurs. It's not sleep, it's not paralysis, and it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the narcotic substances that the brain makes. Yes. It's much, much more complicated than that one slide shows. The dorsal horn of the spinal cord, where the pain fiber comes in and then makes its first synapse, that region of the spinal cord is extremely busy. Busy because of the following facts. There are descending pathways that come down from the brain stem and higher centers. Those descending pathways contain enkephalins, they contain other transmitters like serotonin, norepinephrine. One has in that one region not only the incoming fibers, but a group of cells located there which contain enkephalins, and then descending pathways that probably modulate the response. So there is little question that pain is a perception that is modified by the state of the brain at several different levels. Yes?
Your diagrams on the sleep patterns, where the elderly person compared to the younger one, did the diagram mean to show that an elder person does not need so much sleep, or that he doesn't get it? And if he should have more,
Yes. The question is, what is the nature of the abnormality in the elderly? Does the elderly person need less sleep, and should he try to correct the disability that his sleep record might show, as I showed in the other patient? On the average, the elderly person needs less sleep. They actually, it's documented clearly that the actual number of hours required total sleep time is less. A good part of the problem, I think, is reassurance that, in fact, unless the sleep rhythm is very disturbed, that it's normal to have more frequent awakening, and it's normal to not sleep as deeply and not feel quite the same. And
recognizing that that happens can go a long way. There's no evidence that I'm aware of that one can reorganize the clock in any way to make a benefit. The worst thing that can be done is to prescribe medicines which are taken chronically and which can make that pattern of sleep worse. Sleeping pills may help for a while, but the tendency, if they're taken too long, is for that pattern of sleep to get even worse. Yes?
Does the growth hormone in adults play a part in the repair of damaged tissues? And if so, does the pain help to stimulate that growth hormone?
Does growth hormone in the adult help to repair damaged tissues, and if so, would pain stimulate it? growth hormone is an anabolic hormone in the sense that it has benefits to make cells take up amino acids, it increases protein synthesis, and so on. These effects are in part due to growth hormone, in part due to other hormones that it stimulates to produce. We really don't know whether the deficiency in growth hormone with age has serious problems for the tissues that normally ought to be regenerated and restored. My hunch is that it is important, and that if one could find an easy way to give the hormone, that it would likely be beneficial. I think it's unlikely that one can tie in a simple reflex of stimulation like pain, turning on growth hormone, having a beneficial effect. That may be true for some other hormones. I don't think it's likely to be true for growth hormone. But I must say there's no direct evidence either way. Oh, that's a tough question. Is there any difference between the hormone functions of males and females in the brain? There are a number of answers to that, and I don't have any of them, that's right. I'm going to leave it at that, because that's a tough question. Yes.
Is the failure of growth hormone production in older people coupled with a lack of deep sleep?
Yes. That's probably true, that at any age, one can make a correlation between the depth of the sleep and the growth hormone output. If you take a nap during the day and you have a deep nap, then growth hormone secretion comes out. So they're probably linked. Whether they both reflect a common problem behind that disorganizes sleep and growth hormone, or if you could get the good sleep, you'd have the growth hormone, that's not clear. But they may be linked. Yes? Yeah. Question is whether the high that runners feel may be similar to the high that meditators feel. I don't know of any careful work on, there's been some very careful work on transcendental meditation in terms of physiologic responses. They can slow hearts and they can change the blood flow to parts of their body. There's no question about that, but I don't know of any clear work on endorphin secretion during those responses. And so I don't know. I think that the question of what happens during exercise is still an open one. The amount of endorphin secreted is still very small,
And one of the issues in endocrinology is that most hormones that are in the blood don't get into the brain. So that I suspect that there's more to the exercise high than just the circulating levels of endorphin in the blood, that the brain may itself be changing the secretion of substances during exercise, and during meditation, presumably something of that sort might also occur. Well, we have been doing a number of experimental projects measuring these substances in neurologic diseases. We are not, at this point ourselves, doing any measurement of these substances in schizophrenia or manic depressive disease. But I think that there is bound to be rewards from pursuing that. And at this point, it's simply too early to know what will be fruitful. But we've already found, and others have found, changes in these neuropeptides in certain neurologic diseases. In Alzheimer's disease, there are changes that may be important. In Huntington's disease, there are changes that may be important. So one can only guess that as more measurements are made, that other abnormalities will come up. The problem always is whether the abnormality is an epiphenomenon that accompanies the other process, or whether it's really fundamentally important in the cause of it. There?
You told us about the medical student with the unusual sleep pattern and said he was able to advance his clock. Could you expand on that a little bit as to how that might be done in a person with that problem?
Well, the laboratory setting in which that was done was simply to have the individual go to sleep 1 to 2 hours later each day for a period of time that moved the cycle from 3 o'clock in the morning around to 10 o'clock that night. So you could actually accomplish that in a period of about a week. And by just advancing the sleep stage, get to the point and then hold it. You see, that student probably would have been all right if he had behaved himself on weekends. And would have eventually have been able to back his, but the problem was that he kept slipping each weekend and then couldn't get back. Yes?
You have there about sleep and like the REM sleep, the dreaming, and I know that animals dream. Do you have any knowledge if fish dream?
I assume that's what they're doing when they blow bubbles. If you look at the cyclicity of sleep, it is found in very primitive creatures, including fish, so that there is the same rhythmicity of brain rhythms in very low species or lower species. Whether they have the same phenomenon that we with conscious minds have, of course, is not possible to answer. Yes? The question is whether defects in minerals affect any of these hormones or produce diseases. Many of the factors that go into the production of the hormones depend upon certain minerals. And if one has a very severe deficiency of them, one might expect some abnormality. But I am unaware of any evidence for slight abnormalities producing any problems in these systems.
Well, we know that in certain areas where you have a high concentration of lead,
yes. Toxic amounts of a variety of lead, copper, and so on can produce many different disorders. Most of those are a more general problem of protein production and are not reflected just in changes in the hormones. Well, that's a very important question, because I would predict that the next major, one of the next major frontiers will be the connection of the nervous system to the immune system. And it'll be all tied into the rhythms and the cycles of the hormones, but will also probably be more complicated than that. One can show already, for example, that resistance to infection in animals is changes throughout the 24-hour period, that there are certain times of the day when an animal is more susceptible to infection. A stressed animal is more susceptible to infection. The effectiveness of a drug can be shown to occur in a throughout a 24-hour period. There are times when the drug would be more effective than it is at other times. So that the regulation of the immune system and its connection to the nervous system, I think, will become a major area.
Perhaps we could have one more question, and then I think Dr. Barton should go to lecture hall 6.
Would supplementation of somatotropin enhance the quality and quantity of an athlete's conditioning, muscle growth, etc.?
Could the increased amount of growth hormone make an athlete function better? Most basketball players don't have acromegaly or gigantism, as a matter of fact. There probably are disadvantages to having more growth hormone. The argument would be whether just a bit more would make one's muscles a little bigger and one a little stronger, perhaps, but one is very close to the edge of the wedge, and too much growth hormone secretion produces a lot of bad effects in addition to the changes that one sees in the tissues. So I'm not sure that a little bit more growth hormone would make any difference. Yes? Yeah. Well, I think you're referring to the question that will certainly become an issue in the next few years when growth hormone becomes available and can be given in circumstances where at the moment one wouldn't consider because it's in very short supply. That is, the parent who comes to the doctor and assuming that growth hormone is now available in a vial made by a bacterium in Stanford, California, or somewhere where one of these companies is producing large amounts, and the parent wants the child to be helped along with a little bit of growth hormone. I think the evidence is that child probably would grow a bit faster with more growth hormone. And whether it's harmful in any way, I think, is not known at this point. There's no reason to think it would be harmful, but again, it would be a delicate matter of how much and how much is too much. But that's going to become an important issue for physicians over the next 10 years when growth hormone is no longer scarce and and anyone can give it, and the parents and will want the doctor to give it to their child who's short because they want them taller. It's an important point.
I asked Dr. Boat to take you to the other lecture hall. We're going to have two questions there, and then we'll be back.
They will be back very shortly, so if you'd like to wait.
The question is whether the loss of periods in ballet dancers is due to their thinness. And that's certainly part of the cause. In fact, patients who have anorexia nervosa stop having periods for that reason. The evidence is that one, though, can relate directly the exercise to the amenorrhea in addition to the body.
No.
To answer more questions?
No, I don't think so. Everyone seems to be leaving, so I don't think I'm answering more questions, but he will be thanked for my
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yes, I guess you didn't hear the questions from the other room then, did you hear? Sort of, or not? Because that question was asked, and the circadian rhythm affects a large number of things, and as I commented, it affects the body's capacity to resist infection. It also affects the metabolism of drugs given to the body, so that in fact, you can show that the effectiveness of a drug does change throughout the 24-hour period. It hasn't had a major effect in medicine, but theoretically, it is an issue. I foresee synthetic production of an antagonist to substance P. Yes, there are already some analogs of substance P that have antagonistic effects. They are not as specific or as effective as naloxone is in the case of, say, endorphins or ketamines. But a good part of success in the future in this whole field in terms of therapy will be the production of molecules that are a little different than the natural one, but that last longer or cross from the blood into the brain and so on. And substance P is one that people are working on, drug companies are working on very actively right now.
One more quick question. Lady back there.
I think one has to consider it as a diagnostic and as a way of learning how the brain is disordered. It's not going to produce, as far as I can see, a way to treat. That's going to require other methodologies. This is really a way of learning how the brain works and some of the disturbances that one might have missed. For example, autism in children. Maybe, in fact, there are metabolic abnormalities that one could see that wouldn't be shown in the microscope if you examined the brain when the child died. Things like that may emerge that will then lead to treatments that would be effective.
Thanks very much.